Chapter 12. Well, Nose, you may convey the matter. Tell them that I entered the conservatory that evening from the rear to cut a rose for my mother. Tell them I saw him and Miss Ashburton beneath the pink colander. The tableau was pretty, but the pose and juxtaposition were too eloquent and evident to require explanation. I left the conservatory, and, at the same time, the rose and my ideal. You may carry that song and dance to your impresario. I'm shy on one word, lady. Jux put me wise on that, will yer? Juxtaposition, or you may call it propinquity, or, if you like, being rather too near for one maintaining the position of an ideal. The gravel spun from beneath the boy's feet. He stood by the other bench. The man's eyes interrogated him, hungrily. The boys were shining with the impersonal zeal of the translator. The lady says that she's on to the fact that gals is dead easy when a feller comes spielin' ghost stories and trying to make up, and that's why she won't listen to no soft soap. She says she caught the air dead to rights, hugging a bunch o' calico in the hothouse. She sidestepped in to pull some posies and the air was squeezing the older gal to beat the band. She says it looked cute, all right, but it made her sick. She says yer better get busy, and make a sneak for the train. The young man gave a low whistle, and his eyes flashed with a sudden thought. His hand flew to the inside pocket of his coat, and drew out a handful of letters. Selecting one, he handed it to the boy, following it with a silver dollar from his vest pocket. Give that letter to the lady, he said, and ask her to read it. Tell her that it should explain the situation. Tell her that, if she had mingled a little trust with her conception of the ideal, much heartache might have been avoided. Tell her that the loyalty she prizes so much has never wavered. Tell her I am waiting for an answer. The messenger stood before the lady. The gent says he's had the SKI bunk put on him without no cause. He says he's no bum guy, and, lady, yer read that letter, and I'll bet yer he's a white sport, all right. The young lady unfolded the letter, somewhat doubtfully, and read it. Dear Dr. Arnold, I want to thank you for your most kind and opportune aid to my daughter last Friday evening, when she was overcome by an attack of her old heart trouble in the conservatory at Mrs. Waldron's reception. Had you not been near to catch her as she fell, and to render proper attention, we might have lost her. I would be glad if you would call and undertake the treatment of her case. Gratefully yours, Robert Ashburton. The young lady refolded the letter and handed it to the boy. The gent wants an answer, said the messenger. What's the word? The lady's eyes suddenly flashed on him, bright, smiling and wet. Tell that guy on the other bench, she said, with a happy, tremulous laugh, that his girl wants him. The furnished room, restless, shifting, fugacious as time itself is a certain vast bulk of the population of the red brick district of the Lower West Side. Homeless, they have 100 homes. They flit from furnished room to furnished room, transients forever, transients in abode, transients in heart and mind. They sing home, sweet home in ragtime. They carry their tilde lairs APENATES tilde in a bandbox. Their vine is entwined about a picture hat. A rubber plant is their fig tree. Hence the houses of this district, having had 1,000 dwellers, should have 1,000 tales to tell, mostly dull ones, no doubt. But it would be strange if there could not be found a ghost or two in the wake of all these vagrant guests. One evening after dark a young man prowled among these crumbling red mansions, ringing their bells. At the 12th he rested his lean hand baggage upon the step, and wiped the dust from his hatband and forehead. The bell sounded faint and far away in some remote, hollow depths. To the door of this, the 12th house whose bell he had rung, came a housekeeper who made him think of an unwholesome, surfeited worm that had eaten its nut to a hollow shell, and now sought to fill the vacancy with edible lodgers. He asked if there was a room to let. Come in, said the housekeeper. Her voice came from her throat, Her throat seemed lined with fur. Have the third floor back, vacant since a week back. Should you wish to look at it? The young man followed her up the stairs. A faint light from no particular source mitigated the shadows of the halls. They trod noiselessly upon a stair carpet that its own loom would have forsworn. It seemed to have become vegetable, to have degenerated in that rank, sunless air to lush lichen or spreading moss that grew in patches to the staircase, and was viscid under the foot like organic matter. At each turn of the stairs were vacant niches in the wall. Perhaps plants had once been set within them. If so, they had died in that foul and tainted air. It may be that statues of the saints had stood there, but it was not difficult to conceive that imps and devils had dragged them forth in the darkness and down to the unholy depths of some furnished pit below. "This is the room," said the housekeeper, from her furry throat. "It's a nice room. It ain't often vacant. I had some most elegant people in it last summer, no trouble at all, and paid in advance to the minute. The water's at the end of the hall. Sprowls and Mooney kept it 3 months. They done a vaudeville sketch. Miss Greta Sprowls, you may have heard of her, oh, that was just the stage names right there over the dresser, is where the marriage certificate hung, framed. The gas is here, and you see there is plenty of closet room. It's a room everybody likes. It never stays idle long." "Do you have many theatrical people rooming here?" asked the young man. "They comes and goes. A good proportion of my lodgers is connected with the theaters." "Yes, sir, this is the theatrical district. Actor people never stays long anywhere. I get my share." "Yes, they comes and they goes. He engaged the room, paying for a week in advance. He was tired, he said, and would take possession at once. He counted out the money. The room had been made ready, she said, even to towels and water. As the housekeeper moved away, he put, for the thousandth time, the question that he carried at the end of his tongue. "A young girl, Miss Vashner, Miss Ellis Vashner, do you remember such a one among your lodgers? She would be singing on the stage, most likely. A fair girl, of medium height and slender, with reddish, gold hair and a dark mole near her left eyebrow." "No, I don't remember the name. Them stage people has names they change as often as their rooms. They comes and they goes. No, I don't call that one to mind. No. Always no." 5 months of ceaseless interrogation and the inevitable negative. So much time spent by day in questioning managers, agents, schools and choruses, by night among the audiences of theaters from all star casts down to music hall so low that he dreaded to find what he most hoped for. He who had loved her best had tried to find her. He was sure that since her disappearance from home, this great, water-girt city held her somewhere, but it was like a monstrous quicksand, shifting its particles constantly, with no foundation, its upper granules of today buried tomorrow in ooze and slime. The furnished room received its latest guest with a first glow of pseudo-hospitality, a hectic, haggard, perfunctory welcome like the specious smile of a demirep. The sophistical comfort came in reflected gleams from the decayed furniture, the ragged brocade upholstery of a couch and two chairs, a foot-wide cheap pier glass between the two windows, from one or two gilt picture frames, and a brass bedstead in a corner. The guest reclined, inert, upon a chair, while the room, confused in speech, as though it were an apartment in Babel, tried to discourse to him of its diverse tenantry. A polychromatic rug like some brilliant flowered rectangular tropical islet lay surrounded by a billowy sea of soiled matting. Upon the gay papered wall were those pictures that pursue the homeless one from house to house, the Huguenot lovers, the first quarrel, the wedding breakfast, Psyche at the fountain. The mantel's chastely severe outline was ingloriously veiled behind some pert drapery drawn rakishly askew like the sashes of the Amazonian ballet. Upon it was some desolate flotsam cast aside by the room's marooned, when a lucky sail had borne them to a fresh port, a trifling vase or two, pictures of actresses, a medicine bottle, some stray cards out of a deck. One by one, as the characters of a cryptograph become explicit, the little signs left by the furnished room's procession of guests developed a significance. The threadbare space in the rug in front of the dresser told that lovely woman had marched in the throng. Tiny fingerprints on the wall spoke of little prisoners trying to feel their way to sun and air. A splattered stain, graying like the shadow of a bursting bomb, witnessed where a hurled glass or bottle had splintered with its contents against the wall. Across the pier glass had been scrawled with a diamond in staggering letters the name Marie. It seemed that the succession of dwellers in the furnished room had turned in fury, perhaps tempted beyond forbearance by its garish coldness, and wreaked upon it their passions. The furniture was chipped and bruised. The couch, distorted by bursting springs, seemed a horrible monster that had been slain during the stress of some grotesque convulsion. Some more potent upheaval had cloven a great slice from the marble mantel. Each plank in the floor owned its particular cant and shriek, as from a separate and individual agony. It seemed incredible that all this malice and injury had been wrought upon the room by those who had called it for a time their home. And yet it may have been the cheated home instinct surviving blindly, the resentful rage at false household gods, that had kindled their wrath. A hut that is our own we can sweep, and adorn and cherish. The young tenant in the chair allowed these thoughts to file, soft-shod, through his mind, while there drifted into the room furnished sounds and furnished scents. He heard in one room a tittering and incontinent, slack laughter. In others the monologue of a scold, the rattling of dice, a lullaby, and one crying dully. Above him a banjo tinkled with spirit. Doors banged somewhere. The elevated trains roared intermittently. A cat yowled miserably upon a back fence. And he breathed the breath of the house a dank savor, rather than a smell, a cold, moldy effluvium as from underground vaults mingled with the reeking exhalations of linoleum and mildew and rotten woodwork. Then, suddenly, as he rested there, the room was filled with the strong, sweet odor of mignonette. It came as upon a single buffet of wind with such sureness and fragrance and emphasis, that it almost seemed a living visitant. And the man cried aloud, "Hat, dear?" as if he had been called, and sprang up and faced about. The rich odor clung to him, and wrapped him around. He reached out his arms for it, all his senses for the time confused and commingled. How could one be peremptorily called by an odor? Surely it must have been a sound. But, was it not the sound that had touched, that had caressed him? "As he has been in this room," he cried, and he sprang to rest from it a token, for he knew he would recognize the smallest thing that had belonged to her, or that as he had touched. This enveloping scent of mignonette, the odor that as he had loved, and made her own, whence came it? The room had been but carelessly set in order. Scattered upon the flimsy dresser scarf were half a dozen hairpins, those discreet, indistinguishable friends of womankind. Feminine of gender, infinite of mood and uncommunicative of tense. These he ignored, conscious of their triumphant lack of identity. Ransacking the drawers of the dresser he came upon a discarded, tiny, ragged handkerchief. He pressed it to his face. It was racy and insolent with heliotrope. He hurled it to the floor. In another drawer he found odd buttons, a theater program, a pawnbroker's card, two lost marshmallows, a book on the divination of dreams. And the last was a woman's black satin hair bow, which halted him, poised between ice and fire. But the black satin hair bow also is femininity's demure, impersonal, common ornament, and tells no tales. And then he traversed the room like a hound on the scent, skimming the walls, considering the corners of the bulging matting on his hands and knees, rummaging mantel and tables, the curtains and hangings, the drunken cabinet in the corner, for a visible sign, unable to perceive, that she was there beside, around, against, within, above him, clinging to him, wooing him, calling him so poignantly through the finer senses, that even his grosser ones became cognizant of the call. Once again he answered loudly, "Yes, dear," and turned, wild-eyed, to gaze on vacancy, for he could not yet discern form and color and love, and outstretched arms in the odor of mignonette. Oh, God! Whence that odor, and since when of odors had a voice to call? Thus he groped. He burrowed in crevices and corners, and found corks and cigarettes. These he passed in passive contempt. But once he found in a fold of the matting a half-smoked cigar, and this he ground beneath his heel with a green and trenchant oath. He sifted the room from end to end. He found dreary and ignoble small records of many a peripatetic tenant, but of her whom he sought, and who may have lodged there, and whose spirit seemed to hover there, he found no trace. And then he thought of the housekeeper. He ran from the haunted room downstairs, and to a door that showed a crack of light. She came out to his knock. He smothered his excitement as best he could. "Will you tell me, madam," he besought her, "who occupied the room I have before I came?" "Yes, sir. I can tell you again. 'Twas Sprowls and Mooney, as I said. Miss Bretta Sprowls it was in the theaters, but Mrs. Mooney she was. My house is well known for respectability. The marriage certificate hung, framed, on a nail over what kind of a lady was Miss Sprowls in looks, I mean. Why, black-haired, sir, short, and stout, with a comical face. They left a week ago Tuesday. And before they occupied it? Why, there was a single gentleman connected with the draying business. He left owing me a week. Before him was Mrs. Crowder and her two children, that stayed 4 months, and back of them was old Mr. Doyle, whose sons paid for him. He kept the room 6 months. That goes back a year, sir, and further I do not remember. He thanked her, and crept back to his room. The room was dead. The essence that had vivified it was gone. The perfume of mignonette had departed. In its place was the old stale odor of moldy house furniture, of atmosphere in storage. The ebbing of his hope drained his faith. He sat staring at the yellow, singing gaslight. Soon he walked to the bed, and began to tear the sheets in 2 strips. With the blade of his knife he drove them tightly into every crevice around windows and door. When all was snug, and Toddy turned out the light, turned the gas full on again, and laid himself gratefully upon the bed. It was Mrs. McCool's night, to go with the can for beer. So she fetched it and sat with Mrs. Purdy in one of those subterranean retreats, where housekeepers foregather and the worm eateth seldom. "I rented out my 3rd floor, back, this evening," said Mrs. Purdy, "across a fine circle of foam. Young man took it. He went up to bed 2 hours ago. Now, did he, Mrs. Purdy, ma'am?" said Mrs. McCool, with intense admiration. "Who do be a wonder for rentin' rooms of that kind? And did he tell him, then," she concluded in a husky whisper, laden with mystery. "Rooms," said Mrs. Purdy, in her furriest tones, "are furnished for to rent. I did not tell him, Mrs. McCool." "'Tis right ye are, ma'am. 'Tis by renting rooms we keep alive. Ye have the real sense for business, ma'am. There be many people will reject the rentin' of a room, if they be told a suicide has been after dying in the bed of it. As you say, we has our living to be making," remarked Mrs. Purdy. "Yes, ma'am, 'tis true. 'Tis just 1 week ago this day I helped ye lay out the 3rd floor, back. A pretty slip of a colleen she was to be killin' herself with the gas, a sweet little face as he had, Mrs. Purdy, ma'am. She'd a been called handsome, as you say," said Mrs. Purdy, assenting but critical, "but for that mole as he had a growin' by her left eyebrow. Do fill up your glass again, Mrs. McCool." The brief debut of Tildy, if you do not know Bogle's Chop House and Family Restaurant, it is your loss. For if you are one of the fortunate ones who dine expensively, you should be interested to know how the other half consumes provisions. And if you belong to the half to whom waiters' checks are things of moment, you should know Bogle's, for there you get your money's worth in quantity, at least. Bogle's is situated in that highway of tilde B-O-U-R-G-E-O-I-S-I-E tilde, that boulevard of Brown, Jones and Robinson, 8th Avenue. There are two rows of tables in the room, six in each row. On each table is a caster stand, containing cruets of condiments and seasons. From the pepper cruet you may shake a cloud of something tasteless and melancholy, like volcanic dust. From the salt cruet you may expect nothing. Though a man should extract a sanguinary stream from the pallid turnip, yet will I his prowess be balked, when he comes to wrest salt from Bogle's cruets. Also upon each table stands the counterfeit of that benign sauce made from the recipe of a nobleman in India. At the cashier's desk sits Bogle, cold, sordid, slow, smoldering, and takes your money. Behind a mountain of toothpicks he makes your change, files your check, and ejects at you, like a toad, a word about the weather. Beyond a corroboration of his meteorological statement you would better not venture. You are not Bogle's friend. You are a fed, transient customer, and you and he may not meet again until the blowing of Gabriel's dinner horn. So take your change, and go to the devil if you like. There you have Bogle's sentiments. The needs of Bogle's customers were supplied by two waitresses and a voice. One of the waitresses was named Aileen. She was tall, beautiful, lively, gracious and learned in persiflage. Her other name? There was no more necessity for another name at Bogle's than there was for finger bowls. The name of the other waitress was Tildy. Why do you suggest Matilda? Please listen this time, Tildy, Tildy. Tildy was dumpy, plain-faced, and too anxious to please to please. Repeat the last clause to yourself once or twice, and make the acquaintance of the duplicate infinite. The voice at Bogle's was invisible. It came from the kitchen, and did not shine in the way of originality. It was a heathen voice, and contented itself with vain repetitions of exclamations emitted by the waitresses concerning food. Will it tire you to be told again that Aileen was beautiful? Had she donned a few $100 worth of clothes, and joined the Easter parade, and had you seen her, you would have hastened to say so yourself. The customers at Bogle's were her slaves. Six tables full she could wait upon at once. They who were in a hurry restrained their impatience for the joy of merely gazing upon her swiftly moving, graceful figure. They who had finished eating ate more, that they might continue in the light of her smiles. Every man there, and they were mostly men, tried to make his impression upon her. Aileen could successfully exchange repartee against a dozen at once. And every smile that she sent forth lodged, like pellets from a scatter gun, in as many hearts. And all this, while she would be performing astounding feats with orders of pork and beans, pot roasts, ham, and sausage and the wheats, and any quantity of things on the iron, and in the pan and straight up and on the side. With all this feasting and flirting, and merry exchange of wit, Bogle's came mighty near being a salon, with Aileen for its Madame Recamier. If the transients were entranced by the fascinating Aileen, the regulars were her adorers. There was much rivalry among many of the steady customers. Aileen could have had an engagement every evening. At least twice a week someone took her to a theater, or to a dance. One stout gentleman whom she and Tildy had privately christened the Hog presented her with a turquoise ring. Another one known as Fresby, who rode on the traction company's repair wagon, was going to give her a poodle, as soon as his brother got the hauling contract in the ninth. And the man who always ate spare ribs and spinach and said he was a stockbroker asked her to go to Arsifal with him. I don't know where this place is, said Aileen while talking it over with Tildy, but the wedding ring's got to be on before I put a stitch into a traveling dress, ain't that right? Well, I guess. But, Tildy. In steaming, chattering, cabbage-scented Bogle's there was almost a heart tragedy. Tildy with the blunt nose, the hay-colored hair, the freckled skin, the bag o' meal figure, had never had an admirer. Not a man followed her with his eyes, when she went to and fro in the restaurant, save now, and then when they glared with the beast hunger for food. None of them bantered her gaily, to coquettish interchanges of wit. None of them loudly a leader of mornings as they did Aileen, accusing her, when the eggs were slow in coming, of late hours, in the company of envied swains. No one had ever given her a turquoise ring, or invited her upon a voyage to mysterious, distant Parsifal. Tildy was a good waitress, and the men tolerated her. They who sat at her table spoke to her briefly, with quotations from the bill of fare, and then raised their voices in honeyed and otherwise flavored accents, eloquently addressed to the fair Aileen. They writhed in their chairs, to gaze around and over the impending form of Tildy, that Aileen's pulchritude might season and make ambrosia of their bacon and eggs. And Tildy was content to be the unwooed drudge, if Aileen could receive the flattery and the homage. The blunt nose was loyal to the short Grecian. She was Aileen's friend, and she was glad to see her rule hearts, and wean the attention of men from smoking pot pie and lemon meringue. But deep below our freckles and hay-colored hair the unhandsomest of us dream of a prince or a princess, not vicarious, but coming to us alone. There was a morning when Aileen tripped into work with a slightly bruised eye, and Tildy's solicitude was almost enough to heal any optic. "Fresh guy," explained Aileen, "last night as I was going home at 23rd and 6th. Sashayed up, so he did, and made a break. I turned him down, cold, and he made a sneak, but followed me down to 18th, and tried his hot air again. Gee! But I slapped him a good one, side of the face. Then he give me that eye. Does it look real awful, Till? I should hate that Mr. Nicholson should see it, when he comes in for his tea and toast at 10. Tildy listened to the adventure with breathless admiration. No man had ever tried to follow her. She was safe abroad at any hour of the 24. What bliss it must have been to have had a man follow one, and black one's eye for love. Among the customers at Bogle's was a young man named Cedars, who worked in a laundry office. Mr. Cedars was thin, and had light hair, and appeared to have been recently rough dried and starched. He was too diffident to aspire to Aileen's notice, so he usually sat at one of Tildy's tables, where he devoted himself to silence and boiled weak fish. One day when Mr. Cedars came in to dinner he had been drinking beer. There were only two or three customers in the restaurant. When Mr. Cedars had finished his weak fish he got up, put his arm around Tildy's waist, kissed her loudly and impudently, walked out upon the street, snapped his fingers in the direction of the laundry, and hied himself to play pennies in the slot machines at the amusement arcade. For a few moments Tildy stood petrified. Then she was aware of Aileen shaking at her an arched forefinger, and saying, "Why, Till, you naughty girl! Ain't you getting to be awful, Miss Slyboots? First thing I know you'll be stealing some of my fellows. I must keep an eye on you, my lady." Another thing dawned upon Tildy's recovering wits. In a moment she had advanced from a hopeless lowly admirer, to be an Eve sister of the potent Aileen. She herself was now a man-charmer, a mark for Cupid, a Sabin who must be coy, when the Romans were at their banquet. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.